Well, welcome, everybody. End of 2019. I always like looking back at the end of a year and reflecting on, well, how did that year go? And thinking about, the challenges that I've had, thinking about the things to be grateful for. I also like looking forward and considering intentions for the coming year. And I've been doing this for quite a while, making intentions for the year. And I get into it. I get into all these categories of my life. Yeah, I talk about, well, financial or spiritual or recreational. And I go through, I do quite a bit of work and think, well, how do I want to have this life unfold? And I think I got into that because, well, let me back up a little bit. At the beginning of the year, I go to yoga class. I go to yoga class quite a bit. And when I go to yoga class at the beginning of the year, the class is packed full. Everybody makes a resolution. They all have this notion about, this is the year I'm going to get in shape. This is the year I'm going to do this. So the classes are full. I know this is going to happen. I try to get to the class early. And after about February, March, things settle down and people drift away. So these intentions that we make start getting kind of a bad rap. They say, it gets to be something where we make an intention and we hesitate doing it because one more time I don't live up to that expectation and one more time I'm not good enough. We have the intention to begin with because for one reason or another, I should do this or I should do that, and this is the year we're going to do it. I like approaching these intentions for the year a little bit differently. And rather than approaching it in a way that I'm not good enough and therefore I should be better, which is kind of a setup for ultimately failing and one more confirming again that I'm not good enough because I can't follow through on my intentions. I like to approach intentions with, rather than saying it being about me and this is what I should do or shouldn't do, it being about some sort of higher values, where I'm committing to a value as opposed to trying to improve myself. So intentions. There's all kinds of intentions. Just about everything that we do requires an intention. An intention is kind of the impetus behind any type of doing. We start the day and we say, we wake up and we get out of bed. We have an intention to get out of bed. We have an intention to get breakfast. We have an intention to shower, clean up, get dressed, head out to work. Every one of these requires an intention. Sometimes these intentions are very conscious. We say, I am going to do this. I'm going to go to the store this afternoon. I'm going to, when I go to the store, I'm going to buy bananas, eggs, milk. We have a list. We make an intention of all the different things that we're going to do. And we tend to follow through on that. But there's a lot of intentions. After intentions get going, they get to be on automatic pilot. So that as we're getting dressed, we put on our shoes. And it just happens. we end up just putting on our shoes. We might be thinking something completely different. But even when we're putting on our shoes, there's an intention behind that. Even though it's automated, even though it's subconscious, there's some sort of impetus behind that action of putting on our shoes. And sometimes it's pretty subtle. And I think a lot of our practice is related to recognizing those type of intentions, bringing those intentions to a certain degree of consciousness, so that it's, I'm going to use this word, it's going to get confusing here, using with a certain intentionality, a certain mindfulness. We're bringing mindfulness to our actions. So sometimes intentions are very conscious, and other times they're not. And usually, when we start something, we'll have an intention which is very conscious. I think, and sometimes intentions are what we do are helpful, and sometimes they're not. Usually, when we start an intention, it's because we think it's helpful. Our intentions are those things which allow us to stay safe. It keeps us protected. It allows us to get the things that we need in life, to get our food, clothing, shelter. It allows us to steer away from those things which are dangerous. I better not go over there. I better slow down. I better do this or that in order to stay safe. So intention has a range of things, and some of our intentions are a bit delusional. We may think that this is a good idea, but it might not be. One thing that comes to mind very personally is I used to be a heavy smoker. When I first started smoking, I said, oh, this is a good idea. I was back in college, and my friends were smoking, and I got prompted by Bill Cosby, as a matter of fact, when he was actually still funny. But he had some comic record album about his buddies getting together. Hey, why are you smoking? What do you want to do that for? Oh, it's cool, man. You take a hit of a cigarette and you inhale, you talk, and you blow it all out. So he turned it into something fun. So smoking then was for me got to be fun. And I remember smoking, starting in college. I remember smoking in, worked at a hospital. I was a psych major. I worked at a hospital, a psych hospital. And we had a day room where the patients were, and we had a kind of the office, and there's a window between the two. And the nurses and the attendants would hang out and smoke cigarettes. And, on the other side of the window were the patients. And we set up, the patients were allowed to roll cigarettes. We had a rolling machine for them. We provide tobacco, we provide a rolling machine. So smoking was an okay thing. It relaxed us, it kept us cool. It was, our intention was basically positive. At 35 cents a pack, you can't go wrong. Ultimately, it occurs to us, it occurred to me, it's not such a good idea. As I started coughing, as I started getting sick and so forth, I made an intention that I got to quit this. And like I said about this yoga class, my typical pattern was, I'm going to quit, and then a week later I'm starting it again. And it's like I smoke in a way to relax, and when I smoke, then I feel badly because I'm doing a stupid habit, and then I want to make an intention to quit. I tried quitting many times. Ultimately, I changed my approach. I said, rather than quitting once and for all, I tried to set up an intention which I could really do, which I could feel confident about, which I could do in a way that I would not be shaming myself or scolding myself afterwards, saying I'm not good enough. So I said, this next year, this is what kind of where I started making these annual intentions. This next year, I'm going to quit smoking for 30 days out of the whole year. For 30 days, and it could be one day now, it could be a week later. And so I set it up that way. End of the year, middle of December, I had quit for 14 days. I had to quit smoking the rest of the year. And I did. And I said to myself, I can start in on the 1st of January. And I did. It really changed it. It changed. And then I did the same thing the year after. And then the year after, same type of thing. End of December, two more weeks, I had to quit. January 1st, I continued to quit. And that was it. I never smoked after that. But I really think it changed it. Approaching these intentions, not where it's setting you up for failure, but setting things up, what can I do? What can I feel confident about? And if I don't do it, can I still be okay with it? So anyway, I just put that out there as, you know, kind of an approach to setting up intentions. So intentions are, everything that we do has some sort of tension behind it. Everything. It can be very subtle. I like getting up in the, when I get up in the morning, there's some sort of residual left over from the night before. You know, some sort of agitation or some sort of, and whatever happens during dreamland, there can be something where I'm kind of, you know, either anxious to get going or just kind of grousing about something. I like starting my day recognizing that, being mindful of that, and allowing it to settle down. And I end up going out on my deck, which is on the second floor, and I have some tea and just watch birds come into the feeder. And I notice that agitation. And gradually, you know, with mindfulness, it's kind of a meditation practice, I allow it to settle down. And finally, I'm very content. I'm just there. I'm just there. So that you can have an intention of not doing. And I think that's what we were doing when we sat here. I find it curious. Here I am. Nothing's absolutely, all the conditions in my life are perfectly fine. And all of a sudden, I get up and move. I have this, it's an intention. It's a subconscious intention to get up and move. And it's fun noticing that. It's fun seeing what happened that even though everything's perfectly fine, I had this need to move. And when I look at that mindfully, I say, oh, I was no longer present. I was lost in thought. My thoughts were having to do with planning the day. And even though I didn't think consciously, I'm going to get up and go, my body moved me in that direction. All of a sudden, I just got up and go. Maybe, have you guys experienced that? I mean, that, you know, you're just kind of this, all of a sudden, oh, how did I end up over here? I just got up and went. Those are intentions, and it's kind of a fun thing to be aware of. They are these, everything has that little bit of impetus, that little bit of push. When we're aware of them, we have a choice. We can say, no, I'm not going to go in that direction right now. When we're not aware of it, it just carries us through and we start acting mechanically. So when it comes to making intentions, again, if I'm looking at the large intention of, you know, over the course of the year, what do I want to do this year, intention-wise, it helps to have a very explicit intention, to have kind of the large intention, a large intention in which things can fit under, so that you recognize, I have intention to eat healthy. So whenever you notice that you're not eating healthy, you can make a reference to that. It kind of holds, it provides a container for the actions. So in this practice, in our practice, one thing I like about our Buddhist practice is how it provides this type of guidance around intention. As you're probably aware, I mean, you know, the Buddha did a lot of legwork in terms of exploring how to live a life. He looked at, he lived a life, he had a life as a prince, living a kind of a very comfortable life. At one point, he's bumping into the suffering in life. You know, people are getting sick, getting old, dying. He realizes that there's more to it, life, than his kind of privileged life as a prince. And he went out exploring, did a spiritual journey. And some of the people that he was hanging out with says, well, you know, if you deny your body, then you're going to be able to have a spiritual awakening. Well, he tried that. He denied his body of food and so forth. It didn't work. And ultimately, he came around to the middle path, as you probably heard. And he came up with a description, guidelines, about suffering and the end of suffering, and the Four Noble Truths, and the Eightfold Path. And the first two parts of the Eightfold Path, which I'm going to bring up right now, is right view or wise view and wise intention. So wise, and this gets to be the container which can hold our lives. The wise view and wise intention can be the container to allow us to liberate ourselves from, you know, the suffering in life. So a wise view has to do with there's suffering in life. It comes with the territory. We can't escape it. We're all going to get old. We're all going to get sick. We're going to die. We're going to lose friends. We're going to lose family. There's going to be a lot of difficulties in life, and that's the nature of it. If we struggle with that, if we try to deny it, if we try to ignore it, if we try to pretend it's not there, we're going to suffer. So that's part of it. So having that understanding that there's suffering in life. He also saw that we're not separated from each other. He also saw that we're not in it alone, that we're interconnected. There's a codependency. There's a mutuality. There's a non-separation between us. And this is a good thing. So that if we're making intentions, we're not making intentions about me. It's not a self-improvement project. But rather, the intention gets to be around, you know, everybody, the world we live in, the people we live with. And so the wise view is suffering. The wise view has to do with the impermanence of things. Wise view has to do with we try to invest our happiness, and we try to invest our happiness in things which are conditional, which things that are impermanent. We're going to be sorely disappointed, and we're going to suffer. Rather, the intention, rather than investing in some things that are impermanent, we invest our life in things which have, the way it's put, it's for my welfare a welfare of others and leading to peace. To have a view of seeing us all connected, to have a view of seeing suffering, to have a view that this is part of life, to have a certain acceptance of that. So now, instead of defining our happiness in terms of what I can get, maybe I can align all the things in life to be comfortable, to accumulate, to get a comfortable home, get a comfortable job, get good friends, have fun adventures, rather than assembling a life around things of impermanence, we assemble our lives around things which are enduring, and that is caring. Caring for one another, caring for ourselves, and living for ourselves, for our welfare, welfare of others, and acting in ways that lead to peace. So this, if we start having intentions that way, it has a very different effect. If our intention for happiness is has something to do with accumulating, getting, fame, fortune, comfort, when those things disappear, we have no way to turn. We have no refuge. We're without, and we suffer. If our refuge, if our intention is to live a life for my welfare, welfare of others, and leading to peace, then when we lose things, when we get sick, when we age, when we die, when we lose friends, lose family, we lose our comfort, we still have that refuge. Our intention is to still act with kindness, to still act in a way that can lead to peace. Our ability to have a refuge in difficult times is still there. So everything flows from that view. There's a kind of a metaphor, a story, old. I'm not sure where it came from. I often hear it attributed to Cherokee Indian story. Might not be, might be, who knows. But it has to do with this grandmother and her grandson are around cooking a meal. And the grandmother looks at the grandson and says, "Grandson, what's going on? You look troubled." And the grandson said, Yeah, I had a fight with my friend today." "Ah, yeah." He says, "Yeah, that happens. He says, "You know, there are two wolves that are sitting on each of your shoulders, one on each shoulder. The one wolf is a greedy wolf, an angry wolf. It's often fighting. The other wolf is a kind wolf, a gentle wolf, a caring wolf. And they struggle." And grandson asks, "Well, which one wins?" And she says, "The one that you feed." So our intentions, the intentions that we can have in the coming year, is an intention to feed that kind wolf, that caring wolf, the one that's connected with others. And with that, we're going to have a refuge. And we also discourage I have an intention to discourage any of those inclinations which might undermine that grander intention of kindness. So they both go hand in hand. So whatever our minds dwell in, whatever thoughts, inclinations, intentions that we encourage, that gets to be the shape of our mind. So a lot of what we're practicing here is shaping our mind in a way that's aligned with larger intention. And that brings a lot of clarity. That brings a lot of clarity. It gets to be so that it's not a confusion about what to do in situations. It might be a challenge. Might be a challenge about what to do, because it might be difficult to do the kind thing. But it won't be confusing. So it may require a resolve, but at least it's not confusing. So intentions are helpful. I find them real helpful because it creates clarity and it gets to be a reference point. And as long as it's not done in a way that's judging and I'm not living up to expectations, and it's done in a way that is kind and feeding the wolf, which is helpful, I think it can be helpful. So I'll leave it at that and just end it with a quote from L.R. Nost. It says, "Do not be dismayed by the brokenness of the world. All things break, and all things can be mended. Not with time, as they say, but with intention. So go, love intentionally, extravagantly, unconditionally. The broken world waits in darkness for the light that is you." So, as I mentioned, the other thing, I'd like to reflect. Yeah, a couple of years ago, I met a woman who was telling me that every day she ends her day by recalling three things to be grateful for. And she ends up sharing that with a friend. They email each other back and forth. Okay, these are the three things I had to be grateful for. And I found that to be a great practice. I do it myself. I probably not as consistently as I'd like, but I do that. And I also like doing it at the end of the year. I think it's a particularly good time to do it. At the end of the day, sometimes I just feel like I'm tired. I just want to slam into the pillow and call it good. And when I go to bed like that, I tend to think that it was a tough day. And I kind of bring that into my sleep. If I take the time to reflect on things I could be grateful for, I'm often surprised how much good had happened in that day. These little exchanges, at the grocery store, a smile and a friendly conversation, a walk down the street and you see a toddler, with a puppy or with her mom kind of picking a flower. And there's just having a good meal. These things can be lost in the busyness of the day. I speak for myself in that regard. So I found it really helpful to reflect back on the day, and also at the end of the year, reflect back on the year. And I do this in different ways. Sometimes I think, what every month, what was I doing then? What happened then? I go through, and who did I bump into? Who do I meet? What type of experiences? Try to recall that. It's also a good training for my memory, which needs all help it can get. So I would encourage that. So I think what I'd like to do right now, if you're up for it, how about if we broke into groups, let's say groups of three, and do this recollection of the year. And take the time to think, what happened this past year that I'm grateful for? And share it with each other. And we'll take turns sharing. Let each person kind of have the floor and the others just listen and just think. You know, and, you know, well, what can I be grateful for? And then share it. And just the others are listening fully. It can be your gift. The listening can be your gift. So before we break into groups, why don't we just take just 5 minutes in our own seats, close our eyes, and just reflect on that.
And we thought that was pretty cool.
Okay.
And we sort of spoke about why this practice is. We spoke about wonderful things that we're grateful for: family and connection and relative health and how important this practice is to us. We found some very important deep things. And then we talked a little bit about, you know, what in Judaism might relate, and we came up with community and connection and trying to repair the world, which I think are traditions in all the great religions and philosophies, and so that was sort of cool.
Nice. Did people hear that?
Turn that back on
because
I think it's good for
the discussion. Go ahead. Oh, okay. Yeah, well, coincidentally, three Jewish people found each other and and appreciated the meeting of minds. And I know, it's something, yeah. That's great.
I don't think these guys are Jewish.
Yeah. Any other Jewish people in the audience by any chance? Like, okay, yeah, all right, so there's good representation. But what Iris was sharing was that the commonality, oh boy, now I'm going to forget, the interest in community and sharing and repairing, fixing, or, you know, repairing the world, yeah, just the common interest. It was nice, yeah. Did I capture that? I might.
Yes.
Sure, okay.
Something that just came to mind with me while we were sharing, but I didn't get to actually say it, was just reflecting on the generosity of the, you know, I'm just thinking about Tim and Tawari right now, who aren't here, but you're here, and I can tell you, you know, thank you for sharing the teachings of the Buddha. And so just reflecting on the generosity of the teachers.
Nice. Yeah, just acknowledging the generosity of the teachers and offering that. So appreciate that. Thank you. For myself, Tawari, and the other teachers over the course of the year. Yeah. Lauren.
We were all, the three of us, were appreciating the opportunity to share our practice together in small groups and discussion coming together to share, and how much we appreciate that as as part of our practice. And you offered that tonight. I said I was going to go home and write it down on my gratitude list when I got home, the nice sharing we had.
Okay. Did you hear that, Lauren? So I should just repeat. Yeah, Lauren shared that she appreciated the small group sharing, and that was something to be grateful for. Others? I didn't get to share with anybody. I'm going to share mine. Kathy, you go first, so. Nice. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Kathy shared just going around sharing amongst in the group, started recognizing a lot more than she might have. I mean, she just started recognizing a lot of things to be grateful for. Nice. I'm grateful for I'm grateful for being here tonight. It was daunting, but it's still grateful to have a practice, to be able to practice this way. And I've done that a couple of times over the course of the year with the other teachers, the local Dharma leaders. We've had classes together, and that sense of community has been really nice to be able to have a group of people to talk about this practice and be supported by this practice, which is kind of an odd thing to be doing. It's not the run of the mill out in the regular world. So it seems to be the run of the mill because we're gathered here, but it's pretty rare. So I appreciate that. I'm wondering where to go here. I think what I'll do is, there's also been a lot of suffering this year, and I think I'll end this evening when we get to that, and think about some of the suffering that we've experienced this year. And I'm not going to get into a sharing of that because some of it might be pretty private. You can share it in your own time with your own people as you like. But maybe as we think about it together, we can have a meta practice before we end the night. And just each of us can recall some of our suffering over the course of the year or some of our friends' suffering over the course of the year. And together we can keep in mind, the group around us, maybe our images of the people around us, and have these heartfelt feelings of may they be happy and healthy. So, but before I get to that, just want to create a little opportunity for any questions that you might have for the evening, and maybe anything at all over the course of the year, if you want to, any Dharma questions that have come up this evening or whatever. Okay. Good enough. Let's go into that then. Let's just close our eyes and again recall, look back over the year. Bring to mind some of the difficulties you've experienced. Yeah. The suffering, the losses. The pain, the confusion, the illness in your family, amongst your friends, yourself. the mental anguish that you might have felt. Confusion. Let's all start with a wish of metta for ourselves. It's been a long year, a lot of challenges. So let's begin with ourselves. Let's appreciate that we're able to be with the difficulty. We're able to be here now after the difficulty. And offer gratitude to ourselves for that ability, that willingness. So may I be happy. May I be healthy. May I be safe. May I live with ease. And again, may I be happy. May I be healthy. May I be safe. May I live with ease. And recalling family members, friends, who have suffered this year, perhaps died, illness, separation from loved ones. Lots of ways we humans can suffer. It's not easy being human. Things change. There are losses, there are illnesses, there's death. So for all those friends and family members, may they be happy. May they be healthy. May they be safe. May they live with ease. May they be happy. May they be healthy. May they be safe. May they live with ease. May they be happy. May they be healthy. May they be safe. May they live with ease. And now, reflecting on us gathered here, each of us have had our own joys and sorrows over the course of the year. Some pretty severe challenges. Some serious suffering, serious loss. Let's, as a group, offer metta to each other. May we all be happy. May we all be healthy. May we be safe. May we live with ease. May our families and friends and acquaintances may we all be happy. May we all be healthy. May we all be safe. May we live with ease. And may these offerings of goodwill and kindness that we're offering here today be shared with all the world. Lots of suffering these days. Reflecting on that. People without homes, in violence, without food, illness. Many losses have been experienced this year by humanity, by other sentient beings. May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be safe. May all beings live with ease, live in peace, live with adequate shelter and food, live in community that's safe. Before we leave today, I'd like to offer one more thing. I'd like to offer this poem by Naomi Shihab Nye, Palestinian poet, called Gate 4A, Wandering Around an Albuquerque Airport Terminal. After learning my flight was detained 4 hours, I heard the announcement. If anyone in the vicinity of Gate 4A understands any Arabic, please come to the gate immediately. Well, one pauses these days. Gate 4A was my own gate. I went there. An older woman in full traditional Palestinian dress, just like my grandma wore, was crumpled to the floor, wailing loudly. Help, said the flight service person. Talk to her. What is her problem? We told her flight was going to be 4 hours late, and she did this. I put my arm around her and spoke to her haltingly. In Palestinian, Shudawa, Shudwak Habiti Stani Stani Shwe. The minute she heard any words she knew, however poorly used, she stopped crying. She thought our flight had been canceled entirely. She needed to be in El Paso for some major medical treatment the following day. I said, no, no, we're fine. You'll get there. Just late. Who is picking you up? Let's call him and tell him. We called her son. I spoke with him in English. I told him I would stay with his mother till we got on a plane and would ride next to her. She talked to him. Then we called her other sons, just for the fun of it. Then we called my dad, and he spoke, and she spoke for a while in Arabic, and found out, of course, they had shared friends. Then I thought, just for the heck of it, why not call some Palestinian poets I know and let them chat with her? This all took up about 2 hours. She was laughing a lot by then, telling about her life, answering questions. She had pulled a sack of homemade mamoul cookies, little powdered sugar crumbly mounds stuffed with dates and nuts, out of her bag, and was offering them to all the women at the gate. To my amazement, not a single woman declined one. It was like a sacrament. The traveler from Argentina. The traveler from California. The lovely woman from Laredo, we are all covered with the same powdered sugar and smiling. There are no better cookies. And then the airline brought out the free beverages from huge coolers, and two little girls from our flight, one African-American, one Mexican-American, ran around serving us all apple juice and lemonade. And they're all covered with powdered sugar, too. And I noticed my new best friend. By now we were holding hands, had a potted plant poking out of her bag, some medicinal thing, with green furry leaves. Such an old country traveling tradition. Always carry a plant, always stay rooted to somewhere. And I looked around that gate of late and weary ones and thought, this is the world I want to live in. The shared world. Not a single person in this gate, once the crying and confusion stopped, has seemed apprehensive about any other person. They took the cookies. I wanted to hug all those other women, too. This can still happen anywhere. Not everything is lost.